Hello everyone, and welcome to part two of this special episode of Microbe Talk, the podcast by the Microbiology Society. In the last episode, we chatted to four of our early career members, Colmanu Cathale, Raphael Galle, Natalie Ring McBrien, and Helen Brown, about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on their careers. In part two of this episode, we discuss how the pandemic worked to magnify existing cracks in the system and what needs to be done to safeguard the future of the microbiology research and innovation workforce. I hope you enjoy the second part of this episode.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about how, so behind this idea that the pandemic is highlighting, you know, cracks in the system.
But I think it's really, you know, I'm very lucky. I'm married. My husband's got a very stable job. Mm-hmm. We don't have children. So I've kind of had one of them. I'm white. I'm relatively middle class. You know, my pathway has been smooth. So occasionally I come up against a bit of sexism, but actually I don't think that's such a problem in the microbiology community. Not that I've come across really. And I think suddenly I'm experiencing things that people I've been talking about for a long time. So people who do have childcare responsibilities or people who are coming from different backgrounds. And I think it's been a great leveler to some extent, because suddenly I'm like, oh, whoa, yeah, this really is happening. And, you know, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and someone, again, they were talking about childcare and saying, you know, academia kind of, we still have this sort of like monkish dedication to academia, and this must be your all. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, my mum was quite poorly, and I couldn't give academia my all, and I found that immensely stressful trying to juggle, you know, home and here, you know, work and research and things. And I think that's kind of what the pandemic has done for all of us. Suddenly, we can't just have this slavish dedication to research. We've had to juggle lots of different things, all of us. Yeah, and I think that's been quite interesting to kind of see everyone go through that.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest way to identify it is academia prides itself on being a meritocracy. Like the old school, the old guard will always talk about that's the benefit of the industry. Right? Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is that it's the cream of the crop rise to the top. But the reality of it is it's a meritocracy for the people that want to give everything else up.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't a system that is trying very hard to accommodate across its industry the diversity of people that are in it. It is still focused on very one-dimensional measures for American meritocracy. It's not, you know, accommodating to the diversity experience that you have, that, you know, realities of life that everyone has to deal with. Like you said, having children, having to look after your family in general, expecting people to move, to just uproot their lives because it looks good in your CV.
Yeah, you hear about people where they're advised, oh no, don't stay. You've been at this place for your PhD and your postdoc. You have to go somewhere else to do another postdoc. It doesn't look good that you've always been there.
Exactly.
Like, that's crazy.
It is enough.
What if it's just a good place to be? Like, why should you move just for the sake of it?
I mean, me and my husband lived apart for 18 months because I was doing that. Like, I couldn't get a job where I live, so I was renting somewhere else Monday to Friday. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. Yeah.
And again, that would not happen in any other
place. No, and this was pre-pandemic. You know, I was very lucky to be back in Cardiff by the time the pandemic hit.
But again, it's something I don't see. How can you fix that? Like, how can it be fixed?
But that's the worst way to look at things as well. Because just because it doesn't look like something can be fixed doesn't mean it can't be.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, it is a culture change, and I think that's the upshot of the entire position statement, is that there's just a culture that needs to shift.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't need to be a pivot. It just needs to start being better at accommodating all of these things that it could do better. It just doesn't yet.
I think we need to get away from that. Skills must be acquired by moving around and gaining lots of it. You know, skills can be acquired in the same place.
If you bigger picture, without thinking about how the system currently is, but if the bigger picture, people want to have security, stability, that can be in where you're working, but also in, you know, how long, you know, you're going to have money for example, and not constantly stress over that, then you can think at that level, and then what does the system need to look like for that to happen?
I mean, when you think of teachers or civil servants or something, if you wanted to gain new skills, you go on a course or second mm-hmm. to a different department. You wouldn't have to up and leave and move
exactly.
to the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's just because the whole system was thought
yeah.
differently.
But,
from the
but for us, we're like, well, that's the expectation.
You know, when it comes to measuring success, people are probably not going to ask someone like Gile what it was like for him. And he's probably got one of the toughest experiences mm-hmm. of trying to stick with it and make it to the end. But people aren't going to measure him by that.
It's just
mm-hmm.
like an iceberg, you see. People just see the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They don't see what is...
Yeah.
is
at
is
the end of it, on your CV, it'll just say a PhD. So
exactly.
To show how much
yeah.
you've had to do.
And do you know what crazy thing about this thing? You are in a developed country, and that's why I love to be in this session, so I can give you the other side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? You are in a developed system. You can do your PhD in Belfast or in Cambridge or in the University of Sheffield, and you have almost the same kind of output because you have qualified, all the equipment you need to carry on with your research are provided. Now, I'm here in University of Sheffield, which is one of the top universities, and then I will finish a PhD here, and then I will go back to my country. And someone that did a PhD in code, within 3 years, he copied and pasted, and then he obtained a PhD, and they call him a doctor. They call me a doctor. And then because he has been on ground, he knows the politics in academia, and then they want to make a HOD. The dean knows him. The VC knows him. They make him the HOD. You came to the UK, you have superb research, and you know this thing, but then they met someone that did a PhD locally to help you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you said, no, this is not the way things are being done, he will tell you that this is not how we do things here. So you become frustrated,
mm-hmm.
and then you don't have access to do anything.
Is there any hope that it will get better?
I hate to say this, but I don't think there is hope. I hate to say this.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I say this, my wife will be like, why are you talking like this? You have to be optimistic. I said, you are a realistic kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? It's one thing for you to deceive yourself that things are going to get better. It's another thing to tell yourself the truth.
I think one of the real things I think is really important post-COVID is for us all to remember this experience
yes.
and remember the challenges and like you were saying, just go forward and do
mm-hmm.
something different. You know, this is hard, this is challenging, other things are going on. International students have a completely
mm-hmm.
different experience to we do. Not all universities and not all funders have the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, move forward with thy mind and think about, rather than just doing the same thing again as our PIs did, which we now know doesn't work for everyone,
mm-hmm.
do something different.
Yeah.
Well, one of my like catchphrases in life is kind of like, be the change.
Yes.
So
yes.
I hate the fact that you're expected to work 24 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
so I never have. So like, I've always made it a point, I work 9 to 5, because
mm-hmm.
if
you
I don't like the
that.
Fact that people do it, why should I go and do it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So like, if we don't like something that's going on in academia, do it differently. Yeah.
And that's really hard, I think, is ECRs to kind of, you know, at the moment now, that's really hard. So I'm one woman kind of shaking my fist at the system. But, you know, hopefully as we kind of go on and become more senior, hopefully some of us will make it and we'll remember this period and think about what has to be different. You know, we have to be different now.
And when you talked about PI, let me add this because this is very, very vital. So you have some PI actually expect all their students to give 100,
mm.
right? And some of us, international students, we're not well taught.
Mm.
I'm not looking down on us, but because your system, right from colleges, you are well exposed, you know exactly what you're doing. Some of us just read textbooks, in fact, old, outdated textbooks. And then we graduate with first class because we have the ability to cram very well
mm-hmm.
and write the exams and we get the A's and then we have first class and then we're here. And then the PI is expecting you to know everything because it says you have a first class. And then he's having someone from, let's say, in the UK in the same research group, right? You are an international student. You need to do some part-time jobs to sustain
mm-hmm.
yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then
it's
the PI is expecting you to give 100. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is the mental health of some of these international students should be considered.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the lab. You don't know, maybe I had a night shift. And I'll come back to the lab. I don't even have time to read. I'm just trying to be in the lab to do the work, to keep the work going. So I'm busy with the practicals, but then the theoretical aspect of it, I'm not well grounded, because even if I read, I still don't understand it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And then I need to work. So what I'm trying to say in essence is this. Some peers are very good, like my supervisor, very cool. He understands. In fact, I discuss personal issues with them. They know that. But some are not like that. So if you have a PI that is listening to this, try and understand that PhD, most international students are actually adult researchers. Some of them are having wives and children.
Mm-hmm.
So we're having our own personal problem aside the problem of the PhD. So for us to carry on with the PhD, please consider our mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's a real problem, isn't it? That discrepancy between good and bad. And it's like you were saying earlier, Colin, that there's just no kind of training and standard that PIs must have in management.
No,
yeah, it shouldn't be this lottery of whether you have a good or a bad experience is entirely down to your PI.
Absolutely.
That shouldn't exist.
No,
like it should be standard in some way.
I mean, it's nice to, like, kind of going back to what Natalie said, it's like, you know, there are people who want to be that change.
Mm.
They want to help make that system better and acknowledge that there are all these gaps. But unfortunately, what the policy piece really highlights is that actually most people that are so affected by everything that's happened and acknowledge these cracks are the most likely to leave.
Mm.
And then that just begets a system where the people who are still benefiting from what is on a scale a broken system are staying in it. But that's why something like this is important, because now it's something quantifiable. You've got something written down that's evidence that there's problems here that need to be fixed.
Should we maybe go around one last time and think if you could imagine a better system, maybe what is the one thing that you'd like to emphasize that should change, that must change?
My major issue, so obviously throughout what we've been talking about, I'm working at a really awesome place. It's really well funded, supported, but I probably will still end up leaving academia just because the pay is not good enough. The level of qualifications we all have, we could be making so much more outside of academia. And you're expected to just take the lower pay just for the good of academia, for the love of academia.
For the love of it.
And this has really just been emphasised since I had my son, and more than half of what I earn is going on his childcare. Like, I'm not saving anything anymore. We're just barely scraping by. We cannot afford to have a second child.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't know even how changeable that is. Can funders afford to pay us more?
Yeah.
Or even if there are just, if there's an option for childcare grants, you've had a child, so you've got your grant, and then you can apply for something that's going to cover the childcare on top of that, so that you're not just struggling just because you've chosen to have a family. So like it shouldn't be that way. Like, we shouldn't just be expected to get paid less than
for family.
Yes.
It's kind of a chicken and egg scenario. Like, I mean, the university said they wanted to start paying people more. Funders would have to get more money to pay for the research they want done.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
That's just how it works.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah.
But instead, it's becoming this circular thing. It's like, well, if we pay you more, we're never going to get enough money to do the work we want to do. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It's not.
It just needs one university, one place
step.
To start paying up.
Yeah.
At the moment, they all pay the same, don't they? Like, you look at the pay scales, it's the same everywhere you go.
Pretty much
it just needs someone to say, actually, we're going to be the place that pays more, and then they'll get the best researchers, and then it will set an example.
And every time I've started a new contract, I've tried to do a wage negotiation.
It doesn't exist.
We've only got enough for the bottom of the scale.
Yeah.
You know, like, so why did you even put, you know, bracketing this salary is between this and this? Because when
experience.
I've got, you know, almost 20 years of lab experience now. If I was a medic with this amount of experience in a PhD, I'd be earning £60,000-£70,000 a year.
Exactly.
I'm earning half of that, and that's, you know, fine. It's not like I'm not comfortably off, but
you should be
when you think of the skills that we'd have and the value of them to industry.
So who do you think is the person that is supposed to study? Is it the VC? Is it the government? Who is in charge of saying, can we raise the pay of academia?
I think you're right. I think if one of the research bodies or one of the unis, you know, or the Russell Group went, right, our decision now is that we will pay this, or the funder said, right, our decision is now your postdocs and PhDs are worth this amount. Suddenly, I think the whole thing would
The whole system would change.
Yeah.
It's
just being
brave people for
what they deserve. You can be at the pinnacle of your academic career and you're earning the same as a graduate in a different industry. It's crazy.
And sadly, it's across the board,
mm-hmm.
not only here, right? Because
it's
everywhere. It's everywhere.
I mean, thinking of back to the original question, like in terms of what I think might, not just what I want to see change in academia, but I think things that they would desperately benefit from as an industry. The first being an appreciation for the more diverse roles at the kind of above a postdoctoral level. Like, you know, why aren't there more professional science communicators employed by universities? Why isn't there more, you know, teaching focused lectureships and then research focused lectureships, not just this old school system where you're employed because you do great research and then you're expected to be attracting students because they all think you're amazing. That's you know, 40, 50 years ago when that's how universities run. It's not modern university life anymore, you know, and that there are other things that PhDs are equipped for that you could benefit from as an organization if you choose to employ them. And I think the second is formalizing their management structure better, because it is just this kind of loose pyramid of line management of academics by other academics that none of whom have ever really picked up that skill or have had any training. And even below the PI level, there's this loose kind of hierarchy within a laboratory structure. And it was one of the things that shocked me when I started moving out of academia was private sector does not respect that loose management structure. Mm-hmm. You put it down in your CV, it's like, oh, I was a line manager for a PhD student or an undergraduate. It means nothing to them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't acknowledge it. It doesn't. That's not what management is in a
mm-hmm.
private sector. It has nothing. It's not a formalized process because you're not the one doing annual review processes for employees, you know. So they don't acknowledge it. So I think, and it's something that a university would benefit from because there becomes this much tighter network of accountability and welfare responsibility instead of it being this massively structured. You don't end up with a 30-person lab under one PI because they happen to have a couple of million quid of funding.
That's also the private sector having to recognize that you do actually manage people. It goes both ways,
but yeah, they just, not interested. It's a different system. So yeah, I think it's something that they could benefit from. It's not a hard thing to do. It just takes a bit of effort to, you know, think about how would you like to structure your management formally instead
mm-hmm.
of it being this loose pyramid of hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, the big thing, I completely agree, actually.
Yeah.
I think formalizing management systems
mm-hmm.
and formal training for anyone with a management responsibility is really handy, and mentoring and coaching training as well, because I think we need to get to a point where all PhD students and postdocs are having a similar experience and there's not such discrepancy, because you're right, a PhD is not necessarily a PhD. I think the other thing for me, if I could wave my magic wand and 10 years from now something had changed, would be that we recognize more than just papers and grants, essentially, on CVs. And I think, you know, as you start as a PhD and you're going through a postdoc, and I'm in that situation myself now where what matters is papers and grants
mm-hmm.
and how impactful that is. But actually, when I think of myself as a whole person, that sounds awful, doesn't it? But when I think of myself as an individual, I have so many more skills to bring to this that are completely discounted, and I won't get a lectureship or a postdoc interview because my publication record or my grant record is not quite there.
But the irony is that some of the things you're talking about would make you a better person for that position.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You know, I managed lots of students, but actually that is a skill, and you know, my students have gone on papers with me, which surely kind of reflects that this has been a good thing. You know, I have gone on courses for mentoring and coaching and things. I've done quite a bit of outreach. But these are things that are kind of, they're almost considered, in the event of a tie break, we'll consider these.
Yeah.
But actually, what matters is your papers and your publication record.
So archaic, so outdated.
Yeah.
They're fighting things that actually benefit the system and will make sure that you know, our children want to be doing the same thing.
I mean, surely if you want to bring on the next generation of researchers, what you actually need is someone who's able to coach that next generation, not someone who can get money to do that. Yeah, I think, and this is where industry is very different, that they have people who specialise in getting money. They have people who specialise in managing. They have people who specialise in training. And this is a, you know, you're kind of thinking holistically from a business point of view, whereas I think in academia, we're kind of expected to be a jack of all trades and not really a master of any. And I think that really sometimes falls down when we're trying to supervise, because we're not supported formally and trained formally. And you can very quickly fall through the gaps. You know, I would have no idea that an international student might be working different jobs and having these troubles until I've actually spoken to international students. I wouldn't think when I was supervising students to ask about these kind of things, even now I know.
Yeah.
But I think to just kind of have that awareness and have that kind of coaching would be really, really useful and so much more impactful on the students and the students' well-being.
Gallo, would you like to
add something?
Yes.
When you talk about equality, the equality is supposed to be all humans, all race, all sex. We are supposed to be equal, in quote, yeah? Now, me as an international student, I'm paying £31,450 as a tuition fee. I'm doing a PhD in a lab with a home student that pays £1,000 or £4,000. We're doing the same work in the same lab. We're using the same resources. So if you're talking about equality, I'm coming from a low-income country and I'm paying that kind of amount. And you are now coming to tell me that equality, that diversity, that inclusion, and you expect me to believe you. I think it's hard.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good point. I don't think you're digressing, because if the system worked well, that should definitely not
happen.
Yeah. We should consider
that. At least if you actually meant equality, then at least you should consider that, okay, some of us are coming from low-income countries. We struggle to get some of this funding. In fact, for you to get a funding, it means you're an exceptional student. Yeah? And then you got that funding, and then you are paying this crazy amount of money in a lab with someone that is paying. In fact, some of them got funding, this student loan stuff, that maybe at the end of the day, doesn't even pay the money. And then you're telling me about equality.
Yeah.
It will be hard for me to believe that. So I told her that I understand that your government is doing the best they can to help their own citizens. However, if £4,000 will be enough to sponsor one student for a year, at least £10,000 is not bad for an international student. But taking it to that amount is not justifiable, to be honest.
No.
So that's just what I want to add. If actually we mean idea, then we should do what it stands for, not on paper.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because as academia, we're an international community, but yet we're, you know, the reason this happens is because you as international students are supplementing our education. But actually, if we want to train an international, you know, COVID's an international problem, it's a global problem. So really, developed countries should be thinking about how they're going to train people to go out globally, you know, and really level this playing field and make sure that people who are coming from countries that don't have these facilities do have access to the best training and the best facilities, and then that can be taken back and spread globally. So maybe we do need to think about this differently, that you're not coming and supplementing our education, and that's why it's so expensive. But actually, this is a civic service to the world as academia.
I'd like to thank Coleman, Galle, Nat and Helen for joining us for this episode's discussion. Without further action, we risk losing an entire generation of researchers across STEM fields. It is so important that early career researchers are nurtured and supported throughout their careers. This will ensure that we, as a society, are equipped with a competent and capable workforce of microbiologists that are able to rise to future challenges. If you've been affected by the issues we discuss in this podcast, or would like to learn more about our work with our early career members, you can get in touch with us at policy@microbiologysociety.org. Our position statement, Safeguarding the Future of the Microbiology Research and Innovation Workforce, can be found on the Microbiology Society website under Members Outreach and Resources. Thanks again for listening.
We want to help microbiologists starting out in their careers to achieve their goals, so we have launched the Unlocking Potential Fund, which will be used to provide grants to early and mid-career members. Everyone's personal development needs are different, so each grant will offer a bespoke toolkit to give access to training and coaching according to the individual's needs. By donating to the Unlocking Potential Fund, you're giving those who need it most a chance to determine their own future path by better understanding themselves and their goals. To learn more about the grant and donate, visit our website today.